All right, good afternoon. My name is Harry Portman. I am the audiovisual coordinator at YU's Student Nonprofit Society, and I will be your student moderator today at the session entitled Stories of Struggle, Personal Accounts of Triumph Over Mental Illness. Unlike the other plenary sessions and breakout sessions that are going on now, where we have qualified mental health care professionals and rabbinic scholars speaking, today we'll be hearing from actual members of our community who have struggled firsthand with mental illness and will relate their stories to us. Sam Shum is a student at List College, a dual degree undergraduate program between Columbia University and the Jewish Theological Seminary, and is majoring in anthropology. Sam has suffered from obsessive compulsive disorder for many years, and after receiving treatment in cognitive behavior therapy in 2009 at the University of Pennsylvania Center for the Treatment and Study of Anxiety, Sam realized that there is a great need to create an open, honest dialogue about mental illness among college students and has done work to promote his experience and to get people to discuss these things. Sarah Steinberg is a senior at Stern College for Women studying mathematics. Sarah is a longtime sufferer of clinical depression. Sarah believes that it's important for others to hear from individuals who suffer from mental illness and has previously spoken about our experiences as well as participated in a panel discussion organized here at YU by our chapter of Active Minds. Both Sarah and Sam will speak about their personal struggles dealing with mental illness as well as about the work they are doing to increase awareness of the challenges that those who are suffering from mental illness endure in their daily lives. After Sam and Sarah speak, we'll hear from Dr. Yael Muscat, the Associate Director of Yeshiva University's Counseling Center, who serves at a supervisory, administrative, and clinical role in providing mental health services to both undergraduate and graduate students. Dr. Muscat has over 15 years of experience working as a therapist and consultant for adolescents, families, young adults, in a variety of settings, including schools, hospitals, and community mental health centers. Dr. Muscat will discuss how to cope with different aspects of mental illness, as well as how the Jewish community at large should approach helping members of our own community who suffer from mental illness. Time permitting, afterwards we'll have a short question and answer session. Please turn all cell phones off or to silent, and we'll now begin with Sam Shum. Thank you.
Hi, everybody. I first would just like to thank Yeshiva University's Medical Ethics Society for inviting me here today, for allowing me to share my story with you. I would also like to commend the Medical Ethics Society. When choosing from a plethora of medical issues confronting American society and the Jewish community, it decided to concentrate on a topic too frequently neglected in our public discourse, mental health. I think it's quite fitting that this presentation is entitled Stories of Struggle. Indeed, what I'm about to share with you is exactly that, a story. Unlike the narratives found in certain novels, real-life stories and narratives are rarely linear, at least in my own limited experience. There's not always a clear progression, development, or even direction to the stories in our lives. My story is about obsessive-compulsive disorder, or OCD. And like any real life narrative, it's not particularly linear. I have good days and I have bad days. I cannot draw a simple line when examining my ongoing relationship with OCD. As we know from the narrative of Yetziat Mitzrayim, our journey from slavery to freedom was not linear. There was a good deal of wandering. We got lost, we took detours, sometimes of our own volition and sometimes not. I, like most people I imagine, have moments of freedom and moments of slavery. I wander in and out of struggling with my OCD. A few weeks ago, I spoke at NYU. Before speaking there, I called the moderator, who's a friend of mine, and asked whether it was appropriate for me to speak about OCD, considering my current circumstances. My OCD has, unfortunately, flared up again in recent months. I returned to cognitive behavioral therapy, the most popular form of treatment used today for OCD and similar anxiety disorders. I'd be lying to you if I didn't admit that I'm currently in what I would refer to as an OCD state of mind. OCD has its own logic, its own rules, its own magic, I would argue. I realized, however, that you can't really start an honest and open conversation on mental health, specifically mental illness, if you can't be honest with yourselves and with others. And that's why I'm here today. But before I digress further, I want to tell you a little bit about OCD in general and about my experience with it. I want to first demystify a few common misconceptions about OCD. Unless you've encountered OCD personally or know somebody who has encountered OCD, you probably think about the most common rituals and compulsions when you hear the word: cleaning, hoarding, checking, counting, reviewing, numbering, and list making. OCD can and does manifest in those forms for some people. To reduce the disorder to those verbs, those actions, however, is a grave injustice to the anxiety and pain that those who struggle with OCD encounter on a daily basis. OCD is not simply about being too meticulous. OCD is about being so hypersensitive to your environment that everything around you has the potential to become a cause for concern and anxiety. OCD is, at its core, about doubt. Indeed, it's commonly referred to as the doubting disease. This phrase is not just a clever, pithy alliteration. I wholeheartedly believe, without any doubt, that it captures the essence of OCD. I find it helpful when describing the inner workings of the illness to illustrate it as a monster. Indeed, last year for a course at Columbia, I decided to illustrate how OCD fits the description of a monster. And I want to share a little bit of a few passages from that essay with you today. In my introduction, I write, quote, "According to the Yale Brown Obsessive Compulsive Scale, referred to as Y-box within the mental health community, I am subclinical. I no longer exhibit symptoms of obsessive compulsive disorder. I am, in other words, like a cancer patient in remission. Being in remission, I know that the monster, my OCD, could reemerge at any moment. If it returns, it will inject its venom, doubt, into my decisions and actions. It will cause me to ruminate about irrational thoughts and problems, about worries and concerns not grounded in the realm of reality." I continue that, quote, "To worsen matters, the monster possesses another disguise. It can shapeshift. It, quote, turns immaterial and vanishes to reappear somewhere else. While I may conquer one fear, a new fear will emerge. It manifests in, quote, slightly different clothing each time it plagues me. By disguising itself, the monster lays a trap," end quote. And there were certain parts there when I was quoting where I was actually referring to an essay that we had sort of used as a prompt about monster cultures. Monster culture, it was called. And so here's the rub. Just as you've wrestled with it and resolved one doubt, another doubt reemerges. The goal of therapy, of CBT, is to learn how to accept doubt, how to embrace it, how to live with it. Instead of trying to resolve it, running your mind in infinite loops, you learn how to embrace it. In fear that I might be speaking in terms too abstract, I want to give you an example from my personal life excerpted from the essay I wrote. Quote, "A typical person will occasionally find a bizarre thought or image suddenly enter his or her imagination. While driving a car, for instance, a man may imagine suddenly losing control of his car. Even if the image engenders panic with him, he will most likely view the image as a fleeting, benign thought and continue to drive. I, on the other hand, when placed into an identical situation, will experience a panic attack. Like the pitchfork devils in cartoons, the OCD will whisper into my ear, as soon as the disturbing images appear, that the car accident image reflects my secret, latent desire to harm myself. Fearful of this possibility, I will overcompensate. I will drive extra cautiously, checking my mirror every 3 seconds and gripping the handle of the wheel as tightly as I can manage. Because of the doubt engendered in me, I will drive the remainder of the trip in constant fear of crashing my car. I will subsequently repeat these same compulsions, however tiring and annoying I may find them, every time I drive." End quote. Unfortunately, this is one of the more benign OCD episodes I have encountered. Thankfully, using my CBT techniques, I overcame my fear of driving. Anytime this thought process began, I stopped engaging in the compulsions of checking, overcompensating and gripping the wheel as though my life depended on it. I also practiced what some CBT specialists call self-scare, the act of leaning into the fear or anxiety. I accepted the possibility, the doubt, that I did indeed want to harm myself. Instead of battling the monster, I agreed with it. I replied that I did indeed wish to harm myself. I, following the advice of my therapist, allowed my anxiety and panic to reach the highest level it could possibly reach, allowing it to peak. Anxiety is a funny thing. It's completely counterintuitive. It must rise to its highest level before it can drop. It can only last at its greatest threshold of intensity for a limited period of time. Once it reaches that threshold, it diminishes. OCD thinking, as I explained before, has its own logic and rules. You treat snake bites with a snake's venom. You treat an OCD bite with the illogical venom it's implanted in you, a logic that is at its very core counterintuitive, absurd, and irrational. In the mind of the person suffering from OCD, everything has the potential to be doubted. Did I check the oven? Did I lock the door? I just heard a bump on the road. Did I just run somebody over with my car? I just had an image of hitting my brother. Does that mean that unless I do X, Y, and Z to protect myself, I'll go out of control? The possibilities for doubt are endless. In the times I experience the most doubt, when everything is up in the air, I grasp onto whatever is tangible, concrete, to whatever can support me. I'm truly thankful to have a support network of friends and family that understand how to help me and when not to help me. When I say when not to help me, I mean something very specific, something that I wish to explain to you. Because if you have friends or family members who suffer from OCD, it is imperative that you know this and you internalize it. A common compulsion, one which is subtle and difficult to understand, is called reassurance seeking. Engulfed in doubt, I seek reassurance from my friends and family to comfort me, to tell me that I'm fine and that my concerns and anxieties are irrational. This is, I believe, one of the most toxic compulsions. While you genuinely want to help your friends or family members by comforting them, you're only actually impeding their ability to become better and healthier. It's counterintuitive, but unfortunately, that's the nature of how you treat the disorder. The way you can help your friends or family members, however, is by helping them see that they need help. People from suffering from OCD know the irrationality of their beliefs. To what extent depends on each individual. We're in a double bind. We know the irrationality of our beliefs, yet we can't stop engaging in compulsions and rituals. For those in the room who suspect that one of your friends or family members might be suffering from OCD or an anxiety-related disorder, please help them. While I am not a professional or certified mental health clinician, I have resources that I'd be more than happy to share with you. If you're not sure how to approach this topic with your friend or family member, please speak with a mental health professional at this conference. If you suspect that you might be suffering from OCD, please seek help. You're not invisible, you're not crazy, and you're not alone. We live in New York City, and there are probably more clinicians alone on the Upper West Side than in the state of Alaska. OCD is specialized. Conventional talk therapy, as a result, probably won't work. If you wish to seek help, please speak with me afterwards. I will share with you every resource at my disposal. Your time is far too precious to be spent in a constant state of anxiety and misery. And for those in the audience who have no real living connection to the disorder, or really have no idea what I'm talking about, that's okay as well. Help those around you who might be struggling with it. Remember that saying phrases like, I'm a little OCD, or stop being so OCD, minimizes something that should not be minimized. If there's any wisdom I've gained through my ongoing treatment, it is this. Doubt can be terrifying and simply overwhelming. Instead of trying to flee from it, embrace it. The lyrics of a song entitled Closer to Fine perhaps best captures the sentiment I wish to convey to you. I went to the doctor, I went to the mountains, I looked to the children, I drank from the fountain. There's more than one answer to these questions, pointing me in a crooked line. And the less I seek my source for some definitive, the closer I am to fine. Thank you very much.
I'm going to stand up if that's okay. I'm really bad at speaking, so I'm just going to talk. And I'm going to hopefully make sense. And if I don't, feel free to raise your hand and say you don't make sense, and I'll try to explain myself, because the whole point of this is for you to understand what it is that I'm trying to say. I apparently have a very different approach than Sam does. I kind of made an outline, kind of didn't, but I kind of work better just stream of thought. So again, if it doesn't make sense, stop me and I'll go back and clarify. And now my friends are laughing because, you know, they know this. Okay, so what I want to do is go through... Let me start again. There's a lot that I can say. I can sit here and talk for hours and hours and hours. I'm not going to. I have a limited time slot. So what I want to do is focus on some specific experiences that I've had, and hopefully they will illustrate some of the most, I guess, not important, but some of the most common struggles that somebody with depression has. I have clinical depression. I was diagnosed when I was 14, in ninth grade. Before I get to that, though, I want to go back to my childhood. You know, people like to talk about childhood a lot. I won't spend too much time. It was pretty normal, pretty happy. I was shy. I was a bookworm. I was kind of a loner at some point. I wasn't very good at making friends. But for the most part, I was happy. What I remember most of all, looking back, what nobody would have even noticed or pointed to as a symptom of any kind of mental illness is overwhelming emotion. Every so often, I would just get utterly overwhelmed and I wouldn't know what to do with myself. Usually, it would happen at night. I was in bed and I would just cry for, you know, hours. And I didn't know why. I didn't understand what it was that I was feeling, but I knew that it hurt. And as a child, that was kind of scary, but for some reason, it never occurred to me to tell anybody. And this is the first struggle that I want to talk about, which is cause and effect. When it comes to psychology, it's pretty much impossible. It's usually very difficult to tell what's cause and what's effect. Was I a loner because I felt alone, or did I feel alone because I didn't have any friends, or, you know, which direction did it go? Did I not tell anybody when I felt these overwhelming, impossible to control emotions because I just wasn't, it was my natural inclination to keep things to myself, or to keep things to myself because I was so overwhelmed I didn't know what else to do. I still don't have an answer for this, and I probably never will. Like Sam said, a lot of aspects of mental illness are irrational, and you can't really point to a linear progression. I'm a math person, I'm studying math, and that's really hard for me to accept. I like things to go in a straight line where you can point to, like, this causes this and this causes this, but unfortunately, people don't work that way, and I've had to learn that. So, as I said, my childhood was pretty happy, pretty normal. I went through some, you know, rough times in 6th and 7th grade, but, like, what adolescent girl doesn't? Adolescent boys also, we've all been there. You know, there are certain times in our lives that are just not the best. I started high school, and it was going great. I made great friends. I loved my school. It was a really annoying commute, but I liked school, and it was worth it, and everything was going well. as I said, my original diagnosis, my first episode of depression happened in ninth grade. Now, some people can point to specific events in their lives, like loss of a loved one or something else that triggered their first episode of depression. I don't. All I know is that over a period of a few months, I slept less and less. I was more and more tired in school. I fell behind in my schoolwork. I cared less and less about what was going on around me. I became more and more critical of myself and my possible contributions to the world. The last time I spoke, the person before me also spent a while discussing what depression feels like. So I didn't have to. I kind of referred back to what he said. But since Sam spoke about something different, I'm going to try to explain as best as I can. Everybody gets sad. And that's a normal emotion. That's a healthy emotion. Depression isn't sadness. Depression isn't an emotion. It's a state of being. It's when your entire way of looking at the world shifts and you don't even realize it. It's insidious in the way it creeps up on you over time. Imagine walking around. Actually, here's an analogy that some of you have experienced. Who here wears glasses or contacts? And you know what it feels like when you wake up in the morning and you can't see, and then you put on your glasses or you put on your contacts, and all of a sudden you can see, right? That's a familiar experience for many people. Imagine going through your whole life or even just years or months without knowing that you need glasses or contacts. You don't understand why everything's blurry and nothing looks right, and no one else seems to understand why you can't see what they see, and no one else can see what you see, and you don't know why. And then one day, you know, you put on your glasses and you're like, now I see. So depression, at least for me, is kind of like the first part. I remember thinking at one point, it's like walking around wrapped in a, you know, wool scarf. You can kind of see things, you can kind of feel things, but nothing looks the way it's supposed to. Again, like Sam said, you know, with OCD, you have very different reactions to situations that other people wouldn't, you know, be too overwhelmed by. So instead of becoming anxious and doubtful and worried, I would question my own existence, my own purpose for being here, you know? So if I raised my hand in class and answered a question and got it wrong, I think, well, why did I do that? That was stupid. Everyone thinks it's stupid. I'm just going to slouch down and hope no one looks at me anymore. And that happens a few times, and you stop raising your hand in class to answer questions. When you try to make a joke and nobody laughs, you think, why did I say that? I'm just not funny. I should just go live in a box and not talk to anybody because I'm not fit to be around people. And you can see how even though these reactions are extreme, it kind of follows. I think with depression, a lot of the emotions you feel are somewhat logical, even if they're extreme to an extent that it's illogical. And that's what makes it hard for many people to understand, because they say, listen, I have the same experiences. I also feel upset about things. I also feel embarrassed when I make a joke and nobody laughs. But, you know, I don't go all crazy about it. That's where the disease part of depression comes in, because this whole conference is about mental illness. It's an illness, it's a disease. And forget about where it comes from, why you have it. It is what it is. And there's not really anything you can do about it unless you know. Okay, I'm starting to rant. I'm going to get back on track. So I was talking about ninth grade. I had the insidious creeping up of depression. Now, as I said, I kind of slowly became more and more withdrawn and doubtful of myself and questioning why I was there, why I bothered to come to school, when I knew I was going to get all the questions wrong, why I should wake up in the morning, when I knew the day was going to be terrible, why I should go to sleep at night when I knew I wouldn't be able to fall asleep and the next day would also be terrible. And once you're questioning your sense of self and your value as a person, although not everybody makes this jump, I don't think it's impossible to understand how somebody would leap from questioning their own existence to questioning why they exist and whether they should. And those might have sounded like the same thing, but that's what I'm talking about. At a certain point, I started to think, listen, I'm not smart, I'm not funny, I'm not anything. All I am is a waste of space. Nobody wants me around. Nobody cares about me. Nobody needs me. I'm not helping the world. All I'm doing is taking up resources that could go to somebody else. And so from there, the logical leap is, well, why don't I fix that? Why don't I take myself out of the world? Why don't I, you know, jump off a bridge and kind of nobody else will worry about me ever again? The end. I won't feel pain anymore. No one else will, you know, laugh at me. No one else will look at me. Everyone will be happy together, right? Right. Obviously, that's not really a healthy perspective. So, as part of this episode of depression when I was 14, I became suicidal. I didn't understand why God even created me, and so I thought the only reasonable alternative was to uncreate myself or kill myself. And I started thinking about it more and more. It made more and more sense. One of the interesting contradictions of, I guess depression specifically, is that there are emotions that you can feel all at once that contradict. So at the same time, I felt pain and hurt and anger and nothing. From 1 minute to the next, I'd go from just feeling completely numb, like I was totally removed from the world and not a part of anything around me, to thinking nobody else is experiencing pain that I'm feeling right now. I don't know how to explain that kind of pain. I don't know how to describe it. It's as if the entire world is not only falling apart, but going crazy, and nothing makes sense, and you don't know why this happened, and you don't know how to stop it, and you don't even know if you want to stop it. At a certain point, I started to do some things that many people have done that there are a lot of reasons why people do it. Maybe I'll try to explain the best that I can a few reasons why I did it. So my high school had a funny system where instead of learning Chumash and Navi, you had a Tanakh class and you learn Chumash for part of the year and then like switch and only learn Navi. So we had, but that's kind of irrelevant, the point is that we had a big final in March, which is kind of a weird time for finals. But anyway, I remember this because the night before this final in March, I was trying to study. I was sitting on the floor in my room, and I was looking at my notes for that all around me, and I was thinking, why should I do this? This is stupid. I'm never going to be able to learn this. I'm never going to be able to learn anything useful. Even if I do manage to learn this, I'm going to forget it in a week anyway. I don't even know if I'm capable of learning this. There's so much material. I don't know how to do this. I left too much for the last minute. I don't have enough people to call to ask questions. I don't know what the questions are going to be like. What happens if I fail? If I fail, I'm going to fail out of high school and never go to college and live on a box in the street. So there's, you know, there's some dramatization there. But if I see, at some point, you have to stop because your mind goes in circles and you hurt so much you have to do something. And there was nothing logical that I could think of to do. I didn't know I couldn't force myself to sit down and study because I was too worked up. I couldn't go to sleep because I knew I had to study because I had a test tomorrow. And the only thing that I guess made sense on any level of mathematics was to reach out for the closest sharp object that I could find and to start scratching at myself. That was the first time I ever purposely cut myself. It was not the last time, but it was the first time. And that's another thing that, for people who haven't experienced it, is very difficult to understand. Why do people hurt themselves? Why do people purposely injure their bodies? There are a lot of different reasons why people can do it. and some of them are contradictory, like I said before. On the one hand, you have a sense of numbness, like, am I even a person? Am I even here in the world? Like, I don't, there's a disconnect between yourself and reality, so you wonder if you're even real, and causing yourself some physical pain, causing you to feel something, anything at all, that can prove to yourself that you are alive. On the other hand, there's the overwhelming emotion that comes out of you. And especially as an adolescent teenager, you don't know what to do with that. And even as an adult, overwhelming emotion is, you know, overwhelming. You don't know what to do with it. There comes a point sometimes, at least for me, when you become so overcome that you need to express what you're feeling in some way. You need to express all the pain and anger and hurt and confusion, and you can't express it on somebody else. You can't go and beat somebody else up because, you know, that's just, and some people do, but for me, that's just not what I do. I didn't know how to tell anybody about it, and the only thing that made sense was just do what I did. And I felt better afterwards. And it's hard to explain why. Part of it is, you know, you can go biological and say, oh, you know, pain, your body releases endorphins and you feel better. Part of it is also the kind of relief of saying, look, I'm real. Like, I have real pain, and I have proof of that pain right here on my arm. And I can show that to people and say, look, I have real pain. And part of the reason that's so important is because it's hard for people to understand what it's like. And in a sense, this is the second big contradiction of mental illness, which is that on the one hand, I'm standing here trying to tell you what it's like, trying to ask you to understand what my life has been like as a person with depression, as someone who's had to deal with the struggle, you know, for years. And on the other hand, I'm telling you, you can't possibly understand. So you might be wondering what on earth I'm asking of you. And what I'm asking of you is really just the same thing that life asks of all of us. Now, we're in UC University, whose, you know, slogan is Toru Mada, Torah and knowledge of the world and science, and trying to balance them, even when they, you know, trying to find ways to make them work together and not conflict. Life is all about resolving contradictions. And I think this is just another one of those contradictions that some of us have to deal with more personally than others. So again, I'm asking you to try to understand what I'm saying, but at the same time telling you that there might be things that you won't understand. You might not ever understand why somebody would hurt themselves. You might not know what that would feel like. You might not even be able to imagine that what it would feel like. So I guess the only explanation, or not explanation, the only resolution I can think of is to ask you to understand that there are people that feel that way. It does exist. And it does, and I guess just that it is real. I don't know, how much time do I have?
If you want to leave for questions,
okay.
Maybe I'll just
hit
the tool.
All right, so I'm
going to
stop here. Like I said, it could go on for hours, but I'm not going to.
Firstly, I'd really like to salute the two of you. It takes enormous courage, really, to do what you've done, and nobody can say it the way you've said it, and nobody can express it the way you have. So really, anything that I have to say, I actually don't want to say very much. I don't want to dilute what you've heard from our wonderful presenters. And again, I really give you a lot of credit for doing that. I want to let you know that the experiences that they talked about, I could give you a lot of fancy words for them. They're pretty common. Depression exists in almost 10% of the population, and almost everybody will be affected by depression in some way because a friend or a relative or somebody that they know or care about is going through it. OCD exists in a lot of different statistics, 1 in 40, but it's definitely something very common. And being that it's one of the anxieties on the spectrum of anxiety disorders, it's very, very common. I think many, many of us, or all of us, experience anxiety to some degree or another. And so I think what they're trying to kind of tell us is to be extra sensitive to the pain that really comes along with these things. And I think for the loved ones of the people going through it, what we don't want to add to the pain is fear. This is never going to go away. What does this mean about me? What does it mean about the community? I think what we're doing, I think what the students are really doing is they're trying to take away that aspect of it. We don't need the stigmas. We don't need the fears, because that just takes away time and energy from actually getting help. And I think that they spoke beautifully about help. I think that they're very honest. Help is very not linear. It's not, okay, it's all better. And I wish actually that I will tell you that we, as psychologists, relate to what you said in terms of, wanting things, the math thing, wishing it was, believe me, when I was a starting psychologist, I wished, they tell me this, it means B, A means B, we're done. It just doesn't work that way. People don't work that way. If you experience it, we in the helping profession experience it as well. And we do what we taught you guys to do, which is to accept it. We accept that you come to us for help, and we accept that together we can really get there. And I think that a lot of small steps really can help. I will say a couple of signs that are important not to ignore in people with depression. It's wonderful what you said in terms of it's not just a feeling. When you start seeing hopelessness, worthlessness, lack of interest in somebody's future, questioning if they're worthwhile to exist, you know you've really even reached another level. So you really have to watch out for those kinds of things. With OCD, you're talking about beyond the regular anxiety, when a person, especially when they know their fears are irrational, and when you're talking to somebody, they might be embarrassed to tell you, I really thought I may have run somebody over. If you're comfortable with the person and you show them support and they talk to you and you hear that, you can kind of know that, we're talking about something that's actually not weird. It's just OCD. There's nothing really weird about it. It's just a symptom of what we call OCD. In terms of one of the things that you said, and I think this is a very important point, when dealing with anxiety, what you kind of talked about is exposure, which is, right, the more fancier word. But it's a nice thing for all of us to really know when we're anxious about something. This is something we can all walk away with. Really, the best thing to do is to kind of, the only way to get rid of the fear of the elevator is to kind of go and do it. And that's really what the professionals are there for, to help people go through some of that. There's really a lot more to say, but I want to give the floor to people with questions. But really, I think the message from our point of view is, help people seek help. It's available.
Do you have any questions?
So I've
got it.
One question for Sarah. You spoke about the lead up to the progression of.
Right.
What about treatment?
So that's what I didn't get time to talk about. Are you asking what kind of treatment I personally
get?
What
did you do? How did you find it?
What happened was I had one friend in particular who I kind of had shared everything with from the beginning, and it was obviously very difficult for her to see her friend go through this. And it got to a point where she couldn't take it anymore, and she told the school guidance counselor, who called my parents, and they came and picked me up from school, and they had made an emergency appointment with the, most local adolescent psychiatrist they could find. And, the next 2 days later, I went to my appointment. I started taking antidepressants and going regularly to see this therapist. I mean, it's hard to explain what the process of therapy is like. It would take another hour. But one thing I will say is that in the movies and on TV shows, the story always ends, or the book always ends, after the person, walks into the office. In real life, it doesn't work that way. It takes a lot more struggle and hard work and falling and getting up again. And I don't know if it ever really ends, because to a certain extent, this is just part of who I am, but it's a process, just like living is a process. So
I just want to add one point to that, which I wanted to mention before with medication. It just hasn't been mentioned. And I think with both of these, OCD and depression, medication is an important component. It's not always necessary. It can be necessary. What we do a lot in the counseling center is we refer for just a consult with the psychiatrist, so at least they know their options. And then as people are progressing, they could choose to go back to that psychiatrist. So I think that it's important to not always feel like it's an absolute last resort. If you're thinking about it, you can always meet with somebody, not do it, but at least not wait till you need it that Monday and it's Friday. You know, it's something to find a good psychiatrist. And most colleges, you know, we have one obviously, but a lot of colleges have that. And certainly in the communities, you can find them.
Thank you.
So this question to both of you. I'm just wondering how you are struggling with mental illness has also affected your religious or social experience. I know it's very mental. So we're providing thoughts of why God created you. And Sam also was wondering how this all affects you and not how the world is kind of shaped by grace and whatnot, how you're able to connect in that religious way. Or, you know, Judaism is a very routine and very systematic experience. So how maybe that affects the OCD or not. I'm just curious about that. Okay. Mm-hmm.
Sure. You know, I think it's a topic I think which I'm actually very interested in, especially because when you talk about issues of ritual and compulsion, I don't know if it's the obvious leap, but then you start to think about your own ritual within as a Jew. And I would say that it is very difficult because I do feel like certain things that I do or that I used to do felt like if I took them to an extreme for me, could become a compulsion. Not saying that they intrinsically are, because I think that would be a totally overly simplistic and actually totally inaccurate way to view things. So I would say that I'm not so, I guess you could say, like, machmir with, like, certain things because I feel like it has the potential to be disastrous. I think also just, like, becoming, like, much more, I would say, open-minded as well with this whole idea of embracing sort of doubt does definitely change, I think, at least change my worldview on things. And I'd be happy, if you're interested, to discuss that further. I feel like it's a little bit more complicated, though.
I would say for me, I guess, just to sum it up simply, yes. in a few more words, like I said, when you're, you know, doubting your own existence and you're living in a religious environment, it's pretty simple to kind of conflate the two and question God and question your religious experience in terms of your emotional experience. I don't want to, like, go into every little question I've ever had, but yeah, I definitely questioned, you know, it's led me to question God, why do bad things happen to people, pretty much anything you can think of, but it also helps in the sense that, like, there's always, if you do believe, then you believe that there's always somebody there to reach out to. So, in a way, it's made things more complicated, but also ultimately a little bit more comforting.
One more question.
Okay.
I was wondering how you
feel
different than the world.
I'm sorry, I'm not sure if I fully heard the question.
Isolated. Yes. I have a distinct memory of sitting in a specific classroom at my high school in ninth grade, looking around and thinking, wow, not one person here knows what I'm thinking and feeling and going through right now. That was definitely a component of the struggle to kind of reattach myself to the world and say, listen, like, I can open up, I can explain to people what I'm feeling. I don't have to be alone. But that definitely was a very big part of it.
I would say as well, I think, absolutely. I think the fact that, like, I have to sort of resort to even, like, metaphors and imagery reflects my inability many times to even really articulate what's going on. And I think that that disconnect between knowing what you're feeling and not really fully being able to express it to somebody who's not experiencing it is quite difficult. And I think that's really probably why I do even employ sort of metaphor and imagery today.
Thank you, speakers Sam Sarah and Dr. Muscat. I'm at the end of our official portion of the program now, since the next session beginning at 3 o'clock. There'll be a round of questions further than that. We have to thank them for coming and sharing their experience.